This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock, six cities around New Hampshire will host discussions on what many argue is one of the most serious issues facing our state today, our mental health system. In a statewide effort called All Walks of Life, leaders in the fields of mental illness and substance abuse will convene conversations about how huge shortfalls in these systems have widespread effects. From the person driving under the influence of drugs who kills an innocent bystander, to police getting involved in a mental health crisis that turns violent, to the less obvious tolls mental illness and substance abuse take on workplace productivity, family stability, and our education system. But funding to improve all these is always tight. And so today in The Exchange, as these conversations kick off, we ask, what's the best way to spend limited state dollars? Is it more acute care psychiatric beds, more staff at community mental health centers, more substance abuse programs for those already struggling, or more prevention efforts to ward off problems later on? Let's hear from you this hour. Where do you think the state would see the best bang for its buck when it comes to mental health and substance abuse? What approaches might bring the best result to the most people? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests for the hour. Dr. Sonia Kelly is here. She's chair and medical director of the Department of Psychiatry at Concord Hospital. And Dr. Kelly, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Ken Norton, executive director of New Hampshire NAMI. That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Ken, welcome back to you too. Thank you.
Good morning.
And also with us, Jay Couture, executive director of Seacoast Mental Health Center and president of the New Hampshire Community Behavioral Health Association. And Jay, thank you also for coming here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, all of you, but I'll start with you, Jay. You know, for years, people have talked about the continued degradation of the mental health and substance abuse system. What have you seen in your time?
I have been part of the New Hampshire community mental health system since 1986. So I was here when we were ranked the number one mental health system in the nation.
Wow.
We were actively trying to expand community-based services and introduce evidence-based services, and then the funding started to erode. And over time, we saw continued erosion in our ability to meet the needs of the populations who most needed our services. In a collaborative effort with the Department of Health and Human Services and other stakeholders, we worked starting in about 2006 to produce what was published in 2008 and has become known as the 10-year plan, a plan to begin the process of restoring the adult community mental health system. We've only just in this budget cycle started to see meaningful funding that's been allocated for this, but we haven't seen the result of that yet. And unfortunately, there was so much continued erosion from 2008 when it was published till now that we have a long way to go. We see backups every day in the emergency room, people who cannot get the level of care that they need.
Well, and what was that like, Jay, to be number one in the nation? I mean, just give us a picture, a feeling of what it was like to have a great mental health system.
I think that people felt really proud of it, that you can see on a day-to-day basis, and the staff who work in direct care positions, their jobs are much harder than mine as an administrator. And to be able to know that you can identify what treatment needs are, provide those services, and help people to reach their recovery goals and gain access to needed services, I think is something that people were proud of. And it's been very frustrating and at times demoralizing to not be able to do that.
Ken Norton, what have you seen over the years? And then we'll talk about, okay, given limited state dollars, where should we spend those funds? But I'd love to get your broad perspective on this first.
Well, I began working in community mental health in 1982, so was part of that building effort when we did build to become number one in the country. And while I certainly echo Jay's sentiment about the pride that we all took at that point that we were number one, and people from all over the country were coming to see our community-based programs and what we had done, I would also note that our NAMI New Hampshire founder, Peggy Straw, was quoted when the press called her to tell her that we were number one in the country. She said, "Great, we're the smartest kids in the dumb class." And the point being that as proud as we were of what we had accomplished in New Hampshire, if this was the best that we could do for people with mental illness in our state, then, you know, in our country, then that was a problem. We still had lots of work to be done. I would note on in terms of the substance abuse field that a lot of progress has been made, particularly around attitudes and changing attitudes in the area of underage drinking and education around the sort of depth of what addiction means, and that it's not just alcohol, it's a lot of prescription drugs right now, certainly.
Heroin has become a huge problem in rural New Hampshire.
It has, although oxycodone and, you know, and other prescription drugs are what are killing people more often than now motor vehicle accidents. So even though we've made a lot of progress in that area as well in terms of educating the public and you know, and what needs to happen, we still have a long way to go.
What are some of the big needs that you see, Dr. Kelly? Recognizing that there are so many, where do you see some of the greatest needs when we talk about mental health and substance abuse?
Well, I think it's hard to parse out that one particular area deserves funding, and I'd put deserves in inverted commas, deserves funding more than another area. I think it's a continuum of care that we have to have an emphasis on. People suffer from their conditions to different degrees at different phases of their illness and require different interventions. And so to emphasize one area, for example, inpatient over outpatient, or substance abuse over mental health, or you know, children over adults or adults over children, is to kind of fractionate things out in a way that's not helpful or meaningful. So I think establishing a continuity, a continuum of care, is probably, from my experience, the most important emphasis to keep.
You know, what's been interesting to me talking about this over the many years as we have is that it seems like, Dr. Kelly, a couple years ago, folks like Ken and Jay, you know, who've been working in the trenches of the mental health system for a long time, started to get some help from the emergency room doctors, the police, the county corrections people. It seemed like new voices came into the conversation just a couple years ago saying, you know, we're downstream from this, and yes, we need to get together on this. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I think I am very grateful, as somebody who works in direct care, I'm very grateful for the supports that we have seen from police departments, you know, from folks that are working downstream. I want to give a shout out to primary care providers who have really picked up the burden where there have been an insufficient number of psychiatrists in the area. But I think they're not so downstream now from the problem. They're often really quite face-to-face at an early and sustained stage. And emergency rooms are now facing the burden of becoming providers, not facilitators for access to care, but actual providers for care. And this is not optimal for people who are suffering in the ways that people in crisis do suffer.
And this really was brought to people's attention by the incidents at Elliott Hospital, where a psychiatric patient got violent and really injured a hospital emergency room worker very badly.
Indeed. Mm-hmm.
All right. I want to invite our listeners to join us, and then we'll talk some more about this idea of money, where it should be spent. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. The email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. One more time, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And Ken Norton and Jay Couture, Dr. Kelly addresses, but I'd love to hear from you too. Jay, okay, so lots and lots of needs, obviously. Where do you see the greatest need?
As Dr. Kelly indicated, you really need to think in terms of the continuum of care. But an immediate need now is the backup in the emergency rooms in hospitals across the state. These are people who because of a number of different reasons, whether they couldn't access services or other circumstances were impacting them. Perhaps they didn't feel that they could afford services because they didn't have insurance coverage. Hopefully, Medicaid expansion and the healthcare marketplace will help to address some of that. But we need to come up with a solution so that people aren't stuck in inappropriate situations that sometimes do lead to incidents in hospitals that both from a treatment perspective and a safety perspective are not what we want. And we wouldn't stand for it with any other type of physical illness. If somebody walked into the hospital having a heart attack or other physical injury, we wouldn't put them in a room for 3 to 5 days and say, you need to wait for care.
So just remind us what happens. We've talked about this on this program before, but just remind us what happens. So I'm having a mental health crisis. I don't have insurance. I don't know what to do. My husband takes me to the ER. Then what?
So you have to be medically cleared first. So there's the expense related to the lab work and any other medical clearance that they need to do. And in our region, for example, at Exeter Hospital, our emergency services clinicians would go in and make an assessment. Some people are safe to discharge home with a discharge plan for follow-up treatment. Some people can be voluntarily admitted into very limited beds as well. But if you need an involuntary emergency admission where you don't...
To the state hospital.
To the state. You only have New Hampshire Hospital, or there are 8 beds available at Elliott Hospital and a new unit at Franklin Hospital that's just starting to come online. But essentially, for most people, it's New Hampshire Hospital. And if there's not a bed open for you, you need to wait in that emergency room setting until a bed becomes available.
And what's that setting like, Ken Norton?
Well, it's very intense. I mean, an emergency room, we've all been to emergency rooms, and there's flashing lights and there's sounds and there's people rushing about. And it's not a place for someone to be that is in a mental health crisis, that may be agitated or hallucinating or have poor impulse control or impaired judgment.
All right. After a short break, we'll start taking a lot of calls. A lot of people already lining up who want to jump in with their questions and stories. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. The question we're asking this hour on The Exchange, when it comes to mental health and substance abuse, what approaches might bring the best result for the most people? Again, that old saying about getting the best bang for your buck. Where do you think we should spend our money for mental health and substance abuse? We'll hear from you after a short break, so stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And more on shoring up services for mental health care coming up on The Exchange. At 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, prospects for the U.S. and Israel to reach agreement over containing Iran's nuclear program. What's going on this week at NHPR? Well, an easy way for you to find out is when you sign up for our new e-newsletter this week at NHPR. You'll find out what The Exchange, word of mouth, and our newsroom are planning for the week, and also get a behind-the-scenes look at the station. Click on the Connect menu to sign up for our e-newsletter at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from AARP, offering educational sessions in communities statewide on the new health insurance marketplace and what it means for you and your family. Information at healthlawanswers.org. And the Flexible MBA at the University of New Hampshire for working professionals, evening, weekends, or online. AACSB accredited in a new business school facility. mba.unh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the question of how best to spend limited mental health and substance abuse dollars in the Granite State. We're examining this question as a statewide conversation kicks off tomorrow night in 6 cities. You can find a link to tomorrow's event, it's called All Walks of Life, on our webpage, nhpr.org. We invite you now to join us with your thoughts on this question, 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, one word, NHPR Exchange. And Dr. Sonia Kelly, Ken Norton, Jay Couture, let's go to our callers right now. And Steve's waiting in Nottingham. Hi, Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning, and I want to thank you for this topic. I'm a psychiatrist that began my career because of the Community Mental Health Service, and I love the promise of it, and I'm sorry to see the erosion of it over the years, because what in its heart of it was all people got all care, regardless of income, and got the best care. So my view has been, as an emergency psychiatrist working in an emergency department, small point, it's not the ER, it's an emergency department, that you need the best diagnosis by the best professional at that moment in order to make the best diagnosis and decision for a disposition. So I would strengthen the work in the emergency department as the first line of defense.
And Steve, just a point of clarification, please. What's the difference between an emergency department and the emergency room, the ER?
If you work in an emergency department, you know that the physicians there are very proud that they're emergency medicine doctors. The emergency room sounds like a Band-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
It's a joke on that television show. It's emergency department is a very important part of a hospital. It is a department, not a room.
So more psychiatrists in the emergency departments at hospitals. That's where you would start, Steve.
Absolutely.
Thank you for calling, especially given your experience. Dr. Kelly, what do you think?
I think Steve makes a very interesting and good point. How patients are assessed from the very outset has an important impact on the course of their care over the duration of their emergency room visit, and actually the course of their care and their disposition after they leave the emergency room.
So really good evaluation at that point of crisis really determines how that person is treated from there on out.
Absolutely. And there's the sort of dilemma that people end up in with long lengths of stay in the emergency department. It's somewhat controversial about whether to start definitive treatment in the emergency department. So if a patient is coming in who, let us say, 4 or 5 years ago would have been hospitalized at New Hampshire Hospital or in a voluntary bed within hours rather than days, they're at that point, under the old model, would have had definitive assessment and the start of a treatment plan fairly quickly. Now the question arises, how long do you wait in an emergency room setting in days and days before you begin a definitive treatment? Should you begin a definitive treatment? Should you defer? Sometimes patients are waiting in the emergency room longer than their insurance companies are authorizing them to be hospitalized on an inpatient service.
So here's a question for you, Ken Norton, real quick. So our caller's idea, Steve, says let's strengthen the number of psychiatrists in emergency departments. Dr. Kelly's saying, sounds like a good idea. How do you get those doctors into the system? I have heard that there is a shortage. How do you say, hey, come to New Hampshire and work in our hospitals?
Well, Jay could probably address the challenges of recruiting psychiatrists, but it's huge.
Because I have heard it's a big shortage.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even for, you know, prestigious institutions like Dartmouth, I mean, I know that they're trying to recruit right now, and it's a challenge for them.
And what's the challenge? Is it the pay? Is it that they don't want to live in a small town? What is it?
Well, there's a shortage, and they have, you know, they can choose wherever it is that they want to be. And right now, one of the things that we have working against us is that we are known to, you know, that our system is in crisis. And so if you're going to come somewhere, why not go to a place where you're on top of the game versus at the bottom?
I see.
One point I would like to make in terms of Steve's comment is the importance around using televideo and teleconferencing, because particularly in our rural areas, they don't have access. I mean, the question is about access to psychiatry, and we need to be able to connect people with psychiatrists in ways other than, you know, face-to-face.
All right. Let's take another call, and then a lot of emails coming in as well. Sue is waiting in Peterborough. Hi, Sue. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a subject about which I am absolutely passionate. I had mental illness in my own family, became a psychiatric nurse, and while I don't practice, there are many people in my community who come to me when they are in need of emotional help. And I am finding it, first of all, I was on a board of directors of Monadnock Family Services starting in 1992, and for 11 years. And the services back then, as Jay mentioned, were really extraordinary. I was very proud of the work that they were doing in the community and found it very easy to get people in to get the help they need. Now, it is much more difficult. And I just see people going without help who because they can't afford to get into private practices. There is no room at Monadnock Family Services at times because of lack of staffing, although that is improving. It has become very difficult and very costly for the community because what happens is these people end up in courts, they end up in jails.
That's the spillover effect, Sue, isn't it? Yeah. The correction system, the police, the emergency rooms. So where, Sue, do you think the money should be focused? I mean, clearly everything's in need, but where do you see an especial need for a focus and to spend more money there?
I agree with your guest who said you can't just pick one. I know the Endowment for Health has here in New Hampshire has focused on going way upstream and working with mental health issues with very, very young children, infants. And I think that's critical, getting to these kids early. But you can't just do that and not deal with the older children's issues, the adolescent issues, the adult issues, the elderly issues. It has to be addressed as a continuum of care. I totally agree with that.
Okay. Sue, thank you for calling. What do you think, Jay Kuchar?
I agree with her. And as I stated earlier and agreed with Dr. Kelly, a continuum of care is important, that if we have services available in the community and people feel like they're accessible and affordable, then you're going to see a decrease in the number of emergency room visits for mental health crises.
Or the number of interactions police have with people.
Absolutely. And so restoring the system and adhering to some of the priorities that were identified a number of years ago now, I think, is still a solid plan and moving forward.
Community mental health centers, and that's your field, obviously, Jay. So, and pardon me for not knowing this, but what exactly is it that you folks do? Where do you fit in this system that we've talked about, you know, that unfortunately often or sometimes starts with a crisis and an emergency room visit? Where do you guys fit in?
So there are 10 state-designated community mental health centers. We each have assigned regions. My center covers the eastern half of Rockingham County, 24 towns, and we do the full spectrum of services. So it could be something as limited as the child impact programs for families with children going through divorce. We have 24/7 emergency services, so our clinicians are available by phone or in person. We have psychiatrists, nurse practitioners, master's level counselors. We offer a number of evidence-based practices. We really try to help people, you know, reach the recovery goals that they identify.
And is it free care? Is it reduced price care for low-income people? Can anybody come?
It is not free care. I wish that it were. We do have sliding fees that are available. We fundraise, you know, through towns and grants to try to support the services. A number of the services that we're mandated to provide are not paid for by the state, but we're required to provide them. We bill Medicaid, we bill Medicare, we bill most insurance companies.
So you get a fair bit of state funding then?
The state funding comes generally in the form of Medicaid match. And there's a very limited pool of dollars that is used to assist with emergency services for people who are completely uninsured. But if you have a $5,000 deductible, the state does not help with that.
So, and last question, then I want to go back to our listeners. So what would it mean if community mental health centers like yours, Jay, got more money? What would that mean? I mean, what would you do that you're not doing now?
I think that we would try to staff up so that you could more rapidly get people into services at whatever place in the community fit best for them. We provide services in offices, in schools, in community health centers, in primary care practices, and really wanting to be where people need
okay,
us to
Sue,
be.
Okay, Sue, thanks a lot for that call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Today in The Exchange, we're asking, when it comes to mental health and substance abuse, what approaches might bring the best result to the most people? How should limited dollars be spent in these areas when the need is so great? Again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Christopher in Manchester. I'm going to give this to you first, Ken. Christopher says, are we doing better with insurance coverage and parity? And why in this day and age is mental illness, as well as addiction, still considered by some to be a character flaw? Is this what drives the insurance companies not to cover these illnesses like it would a physical illness? Two great questions in that email, Christopher. Thank you very much. First of all, the issue of insurance coverage, Ken, please, and parity. What that means is, you know, you're going to cover mental health and physical health the same way. That's something that people have talked about for a long time.
So great question, Christopher. And back in the day, in the 90s, New Hampshire was one of the first states in the country to pass a parity law to require insurance companies to cover mental illness in the same way that they cover physical illnesses. We've seen a number of laws, both at the state and federal level, but they sort of always managed to work around them. And last week, we had the final rules around the Affordable Care Act and the parity laws in those, which are expected to really bring full parity for the first time around mental illness and substance use disorders. And that is a key because many people that even have insurance have limits or qualifiers that prevent them from getting treatment for mental illness or substance use disorders.
So how does the stigma of mental health, Ken, that you and I have talked about many times before, how does that affect people's ability to get treatment?
Well, I mean, it affects it on multiple levels, but in the first way, we know that about 50% of people that have a mental illness never seek treatment.
And okay, give us that number again.
50%.
Wow.
And, you know, and that number holds for veterans who self-identify as having psychological injury. So, you know, there is a big barrier that we need to overcome. And whether it's that perception that it is a personal failing or, you know, whatever, I mean, that contrasts with the science of what we know now, particularly around mental illness, that, you know, that there's genetics, that there's biochemistry, that there's a lot of, you know, facets to that. And likewise with substance use disorders that, you know, that we have very effective treatment that are available. And that's really a key.
When it comes to public funding of mental illness, substance abuse disorders, or private funding through private insurance, as Christopher asks, Ken, what do you think? Is it the case, correct me if I'm wrong, that there's even more of a resistance to covering substance abuse disorders because those are really seen as behaviors that are the person's fault. You could have controlled it and you didn't.
I think that
even more so than mental illness.
I think that that's correct. And right now we do not have a substance use benefit as part of our Medicaid reimbursement services. And it's imperative that we have that. I mean, there is a huge need for treating substance use and addiction, and we know that certainly many people with mental illness have co-occurring disorders with substance abuse, and those are the folks that have the poorer outcomes that, as our previous caller Sue had mentioned, end up in, you know, incarcerated or homeless or in our emergency department.
So, yeah, co-occurring means you've got substance abuse and mental illness at the same time.
Correct.
And from what I understand, sometimes you can't get mental health treatment until you, quote-unquote, stop using. And that makes it difficult also to get treatment.
Well, I think we've progressed in that area. But okay. Yes, there used to be the old, well, when you sober up, then we'll treat your mental illness. And on the mental illness side, you know, we'd say, on the other side, they'd say, well, you get your mental illness treated and then we'll talk about your addiction. But yeah. I think we've moved way past that.
Thanks a lot for the email, Christopher. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Aaron is up next from Alton Bay. And Aaron, go ahead. Thanks for calling the Exchange. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Laura. Insanity, it has been said, to do the same thing over and over again and expect the same result or expect a different result. And I do have a question here, but, you know, hearing things like biochemical markers and wanting to dump more and more money into the same psychiatric and psychological solution does just seem insane to me. It has grown, you know, 100-fold over the last 50 years, the whole profession. And as your show is pointing out, it is not helping. And I don't think that more funds is going to continue to try and provide any more help. So my question is why there hasn't been any more focus on alternative type measures like peer-to-peer support groups, people with experience. And when I say experience, I don't mean psychologists and psychiatrists. I mean folks that have come from the mental health difficulties side of things. There are groups out there. Icarus Project is one of them. and there's many others out there that if it got more airtime to be known about them, I think we would be able to find ourselves potentially in a better spot than we are now than dumping more money into drugging. I mean, Johnson & Johnson was just in the news, weren't they, about off-label prescriptions?
You know, this is a great point, Aaron, and something that has come up a lot. All of you, I'm sure you're way more familiar with it than I am. But the idea, Jay Couture, that, you know, we're just giving people meds and shoving them out the door and crossing our fingers and hoping they're okay. We're not giving them that, you know, rich experience that might really help them thrive.
And I don't think that that's accurate. I think that our state is one that had the first Office of Family and Consumer Affairs for behavioral health, and we do have peer support agencies throughout the state that have a strong presence in their communities.
Peer support means, again,
it's a peer-to-peer environment, so they are owned and operated by people who have severe and persistent mental illness, and they're there to be a support in the community. We have a number of NAMI programs, family-to-family, people who are willing to go out and educate others about their experience and help them through this journey of treatment. And again, it's not just medication, that every person has a right to an individualized treatment plan that helps map out what their journey to recovery will look like. And that may include medications. It may not. It could include therapy services or group services or a referral to the peer agency.
So you disagree with the impression that a lot of people have, which is, you know, we're just medicating people because it's easier and cheaper. And I have heard that that's what the insurance companies promote, too, because it's faster than talk therapy.
And there's certainly, it's easier to get an authorization from an insurance company if someone has an HMO for medication services, or sometimes you don't even need an authorization, but you would for therapy services.
Yeah. Dr. Kelly, I want to hear from you, too, on this. Thanks a lot for the call, Aaron. Good point.
Well, I just would add that there's a strong body of evidence that is not a new body of evidence that says that it requires typically for most people the combination of both psychotherapy and psychopharmacology. And the way that when I'm speaking with patients about this in a direct care role, the way I explain it to them and the way I try to think about it myself is that medications lay the cement it's like a cement foundation in a house that stabilizes the entire structure. And psychotherapy is the wooden structure that you build on that cement foundation. And very important to have for a stable structure, the combination of the both. A lot of data to support that in the research.
So it gets you on your feet so you can continue with the rest
of
the plan.
So you can do the work. So it's not this or that. It's really both.
All right. We'll take a lot more of your comments and questions after a short break. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, prospects for the U.S. and Israel to reach agreement over containing Iran's nuclear program. Then John Grisham's latest novel is the long-awaited sequel to A Time to Kill. It's a story about race and inheritance in a rural Mississippi town. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members in Palace Theater in Manchester presenting the holiday tradition, The Nutcracker, November 29th, 30th, and December 1st. Performance times and tickets at palacetheater.org. And Works Bakery Cafe, wholesale breakfast and lunch with humanly raised hormone and antibiotic-free meats. Concord, Keene, Durham, Portsmouth, and WorksBakeryCafe.com. 940, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're asking how best to spend limited mental health and substance abuse dollars in New Hampshire. We're looking at this question as a statewide conversation kicks off tomorrow night in six cities around the state. You can find a link to tomorrow's event organized by New Hampshire Listens. It's called All Walks of Life on our webpage, nhpr.org. You can join us now with your thoughts and comments on this question, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Keep those emails short. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Before we go back to our listeners, Ken Norton, I know you wanted to also jump in on Aaron's point saying that he feels the society focuses too much on medicines and not enough on peer-to-peer support. Go ahead, Ken.
Well, I think Aaron raised a lot of very important issues there. And I've just finished a great book called Anatomy of an Epidemic by James Whitaker that gets at some of these points that he's talked about in terms of the focus on pharmaceuticals. And the reality is that we have not opened the door to other alternative treatments, as Aaron has pointed out. And we really, even though, as Jay had indicated, we do have a strong peer support network in New Hampshire on the substance abuse side, we also have some good peer supports. There's Hope for New Hampshire that provides recovery coaches, and we certainly know about AA and Al-Anon. But insurance companies typically don't reimburse for those types of alternative services. And, you know, whether we know things like exercise and diet and nutrition and other more holistic things are very important to somebody's overall recovery and well-being, and those often aren't provided under insurance coverage.
So if that's a problem, Ken, you're saying don't necessarily look at the individual or look at the provider, look at the insurer, because they're not covering those other types of services. They're just paying for the pills.
We need to open the door for more alternative treatments to be covered by insurers.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because we just got an email from Robert in Epsom who says, is diet and exercise an evidence-based first course of treatment for mental illness? And you just mentioned that. Ken, Jay, do you know?
Throughout the state of New Hampshire, there's a program called In Shape that was originally started at Monadnock Family Services and has evolved into a broader program, Healthy Choices, Healthy Changes, that really is trying to integrate that. I don't know that, again, there's nothing that we've talked about that you can really isolate out and say this is the magic thing that will fix everything. But eating healthier and making better choices about substances and smoking. We know that our population that we see at the community mental health centers, they die 25 years younger than the average person. And so anything we can do to integrate better and healthier choices, I think factors in and will help with the treatment process.
Well, and here's another question stemming from Robert's question. And thanks, Robert, for the email. So, you know, Ken, we all know that a good diet and exercise help prevent certain types of cancers, heart disease, diabetes. Are there preventative things you can do for mental health? Or is this just something that's going to happen to you, you know, if you have the wrong biochemical marker, so to speak?
No, I mean, I think that there is a lot of evidence and research showing that things like sleep, like diet, like exercise can all be important protective factors is the term that we use, meaning that it reduces the risk that you might have for a mental illness or a substance use disorder. And some people have higher risk levels because of family makeup or, you know, situations that have happened to them, history of trauma or other things. And if we boost those protective factors, then we can reduce the incidence.
All right. Thanks for that email. Again, the email address, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Post a comment there. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. David's in Concord. Hi, David. Thanks for waiting. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. I'm calling as a consumer have family members who have mental illness from time to time, substance abuse from time to time. So it's very personal. I'm not happy to hear that, that corrections and police and emergency room are well trained. I think that's a sign of the deterioration of the care, and I'm not happy about looking backward to the era of when we were number one, because I think the country is very different today. I'm asking your panel, is there room for me to be optimistic and for the listeners to be optimistic if we're going to see a shift from state funding of these services in the future, in the next 5 years, to private insurance as we get almost much closer to universal health care and substance and mental health is covered by insurance? Is the funding not going to be from state government but from private insurers, Laura?
Yeah, David, this is a great question and one I definitely want to present to the three of you. You know, Dr. Kelly, he's right. A lot of the focus has been in this state on state funding, state cutbacks. What about the private insurers? How big a role are they playing now, and will they play a bigger role in the future? And by private insurers, I don't just mean companies. I also mean a lot of folks are covered by Medicare and Medicaid.
Well, I think When I'm considering this, and I'm not an expert in the economics of healthcare, but I think at the other end of the spectrum, it's more than common sense to say that it makes good economic sense to look after mental health issues. I think there's a lot of data to support that, that the longer you wait to intervene in mental health crises, the longer you defer appropriate and definitive mental health care treatment, the more expensive the process becomes. I think in times of economic downturn like what we have seen over the last 4 or 5 years, there's a tendency to want to cut corners and a tendency to want to kind of save money. And appeals to conscience in this economic environment don't work, has been my experience or my impression. But I think appeals to economic logic make a lot of sense. And there is a tremendous amount of evidence that supports the notion that early and comprehensive interventions make good economic sense. And I think when the insurance companies can connect those dots and decide that it will actually be in their economic interest to allow early and comprehensive intervention, I think you may see some change. Beyond that, I can't say more specifically.
Yeah. Well, and Jay, one concern that you hear is from the insurers is, hey, look, you know, if we offer a wide range of mental health and substance abuse services, our overall rates for everybody will go up. So that's the other side of this economic ledger.
But if the trade-off is that they're not using the more expensive services that are farther down the line, they're
the ER.
Not going to the emergency room, they're not needing as frequent inpatient hospitalizations, it does make economic sense, and it makes clinical sense. You know, being able to intervene at the earliest possible time in someone's illness, whether it's mental illness or cancer, is going to be more effective, likely have a better outcome, and cost less.
Let's take another call if we could. And then again, the number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. John's waiting in Guilford. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call. I'll try to be quick. I think there's still a stigma around mental illness. People with developmental disabilities get all kinds of state services at much greater cost. They get full services. They get housing. They get transportation, they get activities. It's all provided for them because of their defined, you know, disability. And I think that's an issue that people with mental illness as well, take your medication, you'll be fine. I've been dealing with a young man in Laconia, and he's been in the ER 5 times, and several times he waited 3 or 4 days, and they either released him or... I think there should be more funding for emergency services. And one last thing, I think the bar is so high. Basically, if somebody's committed involuntarily, it's when there's such concern that they're actively going to commit suicide or a homicide. And if you know all the news reports of people, why didn't we do something sooner when somebody goes in and shoots people in the mall or there's somebody that has an outburst in an emergency room? I think that issue right there needs to be addressed, as the bar is set so high that people wait and wait for help when they really need the help, and we can't do anything until they do something drastic. And I think that's a big issue.
John, you said you've been working with a young man who was, you know, hospitalized a couple times, had to spend several days in the emergency department, and then was released. Where was he released to after this mental health crisis that brought him to the emergency department?
Well, the first time he went to Concord, and when they released him, he was supposed to have aftercare, and he was released back to the community, and there was nobody there. There was some miscommunication. So when he arrived, there was nobody there from the community mental health center to work with him, and it was a few days later that they got in touch with him. So it was, he was very angry because he felt like, well, you know, and part of it's his responsibility. People with mental illness often are their own worst enemy because they say one thing and they'll do something else. And that's the other issue is, you know, it's very hard sometimes when you're not totally, you know, mentally capable and you blame and you know, you blame everybody else for your problems and you're not taking responsibility. So that's what's very difficult, is being able to get somebody to be responsible to do their part so that they can get the help that they need. So that was one issue, is that there wasn't aftercare. This recent time, he's actually in Franklin, which is a new facility that opened up October 1st. So we are taking steps forward. There's still a lot of room for improvement. But one of the issues is the bar is set very high for people, and they often have to wait, and the doctor comes in and says,
Well, John, let's address that. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, because this is a great story, and thank you for helping out this one young man. But there's a couple questions I want to dig into, and we're running out of time. So, Ken, to you first, the idea that John says the bar is set so high for folks to get help, a little bit of resentment that other people with challenges, he mentioned folks with developmental disabilities, don't have to meet such a tough threshold.
Well, they're really important points, and to try to separate them for a second, I mean, that point about what it takes legally to have somebody involuntarily admitted to a facility for treatment or to involuntarily treat somebody. I mean, that is a huge violation of an individual's civil liberties to hold them against their will first, and then to treat them against their will second. And our courts, our country, whatever, have struggled with trying to find the appropriate balance for that. And there's a lot of people that believe that there should be no involuntary treatment. And there's a lot of people that believe that we're not, as John pointed out, open enough to getting people the help that they need, particularly if they're, not functioning or they're...
Or not doing what he was supposed to do. And I appreciate, John's point. He said, look, he also, this young man, should have taken some steps, but didn't. So it looks like you want to jump in, Dr. Kelly, I have a question for you too. Jake,
well, I was just going to say that speaking to the issue of, folks having a difficult time, for example, getting themselves to appointments or accessing what care may be available, I realize that in talking about the continuum of care that I haven't really sort of specifically indicated what that is.
And he started to spell that out for us, which was helpful.
And I think the building blocks in many successful mental health systems include, for example, respite beds, assertive community treatment teams, mobile crisis teams. And what it really speaks to is that people have a range of different responses to illness at a range of different points in their in the course of their illness and need different levels of response. Right now what we have is you either go inpatient or you have traditional ambulatory care where you're able to get yourself to the clinic. But in between that, there is a range of different abilities that patients have to access care. Assertive community treatment teams bring the treatment to the patient in the community. Mobile crisis teams go out to the patient who's in crisis in the community.
So
and
you
do
don't
the
have
assessment
to get yourself
field.
To the
exactly.
community mental health center or the
and
hospital.
And those are well demonstrated across decades and across large numbers of people to be efficacious interventions.
So who pays for those?
It's a variety of funding sources, typically or traditionally. It's included private supports, state supports, federal supports.
I'd love to get one more call in if we could. And this is Peter in Concord. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling The Exchange. Go ahead, please.
Laura, thank you for the program and all the different ways that you help our community talk about these important issues. My comment is that we have to change the nature of the conversation with our leadership at the state level. We have to develop a comprehensive study of what the problems are and what it will cost to address them in an appropriate manner. And then in a 3 to 5 year plan, we have to fund that. It's not about finding a way to use the wrong amount of dollars in the best way. It's about getting the dollars that are necessary to properly address this moral issue in our society and help families and individuals maintain a level of life that is appropriate and fulfilling.
Peter, thank you so much for the call, and I know everybody wants to talk about this. Jay, I'd love to hear from you.
Well, that was exactly the intent behind creating the 10-year plan that was published in 2008. I didn't bring the 10-year budget with me that was developed at that time, but there was a budget that was developed. It's not dissimilar to the thought process behind the 10-year highway plan or the 10-year university capital building plan. But our needs, unlike those plans that continue to move forward, ours have, until the funding that was allocated in this biennium, not been included on the list, and we need to change that.
That work has been done. What Peter says, look, have a conversation. What are the problems, and what's it going to take to address them? You're saying that conversation was had in the mid-2000s. We came out with this 10-year plan in 2008.
Yes.
And we haven't funded it yet.
Right. We've just begun that process, but it's going to require a long commitment. This is not something that we ended up where we are today in 1 year, and we're not going to fix it in 1 year.
Well, and we keep getting to this state dollars, state dollars, state dollars. I mean, again, what about private dollars? You know, could they play a greater role in this?
Yes. Yeah. And our experience, a number of the components of assertive community treatment teams are not covered by private funders. They're paid for only by Medicaid at this point in time. Some of the components, psychiatry, therapist services are, but the community-based services where you are going out and wrapping services around to help people stay in the community, Medicaid is pretty much the only funder.
Okay. Love your last thoughts on Peter's comments. Go ahead, Ken Norton.
Well, I think one of the things that's really key here is about advocacy, and we have not done as well advocating as, you know, as John pointed out, as other systems, and even David, the previous caller, about health insurance. And, you know, we're consumers of health insurance, private insurance, and we should be saying what it is that's important for us and our families. So we need to be better advocates around how those dollars get spent.
Yeah. Dr. Kelly, final thoughts from you?
Just that I hope that people can respond both to the economic logic of this as well as appeals of conscience. I do think it's a moral imperative that we look after the suffering members of our society, apart from any economic arguments.
All right. All of you, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it. Thanks. Dr. Kelly, thank you for your time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Ken Norton, thank you.
Great to be here.
And Jay Kuchar, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Again, if you want to find out more about that statewide conversation that kicks off tomorrow night in 6 cities around New Hampshire, you can find a link to tomorrow's event called All Walks of Life on our webpage, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, American politics and the Asian Pacific. President Obama says he wants to pivot east, moving away from the Middle East and more toward countries like Japan, South Korea, and especially China, given its economic might and concerns about its growing military. We'll talk about all this with Harvard's Asia expert, Kathleen Maloney. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from UR members. And support also comes to us from Restaurant Week Portsmouth and the Seacoast, a 10-day culinary experience featuring 45 restaurants November 7th to the 16th. Details at restaurantweekportsmouth.com. And the New Hampshire Moose License Plate Program, offering moose license plates as a holiday gift idea to support the state's natural, historical, and cultural heritage. Mooseplate.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. After 3 days of talks in Geneva led by the U.S., negotiators failed to reach a deal on Iran's nuclear weapons program. Israel was not one of the countries at the table, but the country's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, made his